What you're about to hear was aired on Planet Philadelphia, environmental radio show on Germantown Community Radio, 92.9 FM, WGGTLP in Philadelphia, and on gtownradio.com. This is Kay Wood with Planet Philadelphia, and I will be speaking today with Professor Shannon Bell. She's a professor of sociology at the Department of Sociology at Virginia Tech, and with Russell Chisholm. He's the co-director of the Protect Our Water Heritage Rights Coalition. Hi, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having us.
So we'll be talking about how people participate in decision-making about oil and gas infrastructure projects. And you did a study. But before we get into that, could you tell people a little bit about yourselves, and then we'll get into the study?
Sure. I'm Shannon Bell, professor of sociology at Virginia Tech. I am primarily an environmental sociologist, and most of my research has focused on the effects of fossil fuels on rural communities, and with particular attention to the coal industry and now natural gas pipelines. And so the research project that Russell and I were part of was investigating the mental health impacts of pipeline development on nearby communities.
And Russell?
Yes, thank you for having us on this. I'm in my role as co-director of the Protect Our Water Heritage Rights Coalition. I help with a lot of the grassroots organizing in rural spaces like Shannon is describing, as we were confronting a proposal for a 303-mile fracked gas pipeline from northern West Virginia down to southern Virginia. And as they select these routes, you know, we believe they intentionally move them through communities like mine that are not going to have necessarily the resources or even the social networks and those kinds of things to effectively resist those projects and turn them back from being approved in our communities. So that particular campaign's been going on now for about 10 years.
Shannon, you and your co-authors decided to study mental health. And I was wondering why that, because mostly people have studied physical effects of oil and gas infrastructure.
Sure. Yeah. So I moved to Blacksburg in 2017, which was a few years after the Mountain Valley Pipeline project had first been proposed. And local communities had already been intensely opposing the pipeline project for 3 years at that point. And so as I learned more about this pipeline, I was really struck by the fact that although an environmental impact statement had been conducted during the permitting process for the Mountain Valley Pipeline, possible mental health effects on local populations were not considered, despite the fact that the environmental impact statements are required to consider possible health effects on local populations. And we know from environmental health research that living near industrial activity is associated with increased stress, depressive symptoms, and feelings of powerlessness. So this just really felt like a really problematic oversight, that possible mental health impacts weren't being considered. And so I just really felt like mental health needed to be studied within the context of permitting and construction of natural gas pipelines, especially given the fact that we've been in the midst of a pipeline building boom over the past two decades or so. And so I approached Russell and other folks with the Power Coalition who were affected by the Mountain Valley Pipeline to basically ask their permission and seek their approval to study this topic through a mail survey, which was the first stage of this research. And then I also enlisted the help of Professor Michael Hughes, who is the second author on the study and is a mental health sociologist at Virginia Tech, so that he could help me develop the survey instrument so that we could include standardized measures of mental health.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the methodology. You said mail surveys, and I was wondering if there might be a certain bias, because I think people generally complain about problems more than they talk about things that are going well.
Yes. So we spent a lot of time trying to make sure that the survey would be done in a way that would get a lot of people to respond, first of all, but also so the focus wasn't only on the Mountain Valley Pipeline. So there were actually three kind of waves of data collection. And this first stage was a 92-question mail survey that we sent to residents living in 10 of the counties through which the Mountain Valley Pipeline was being built. And so we contracted with New River Geographics to create a GIS database using county tax assessment data. And we retrieved all of these all of the addresses that fell within the 1,115 foot wide potential impact radius, or commonly known as the blast zone, in these 10 counties. And then we also drew a random sample of addresses that were at least 10 miles away from the pipeline in those same counties to serve as our control group. And in all, we received 783 responses to this mail survey, with a healthy portion of them from the control group. 350 were from the control group. We did that. We also, the survey itself was not titled anything about the Mountain Valley Pipeline. It was titled Quality of Life in Rural West Virginia or Virginia, depending on which state the person was in. And of the 92 questions, only 10 of them had to do with the Mountain Valley Pipeline. The first 23 questions were focused on people's land use, how long they had lived in their communities, the types of things that they like to do on their land, how connected they are to their communities. And so we were looking at a lot of things in this survey, not just about the Mountain Valley Pipeline. And so those were some of the ways that we try to control for what's called non-response bias. So basically the idea that only people who are concerned about an issue would respond to a survey.
Russell, did you want to say anything here?
Oh, definitely. I think if government agencies, decision makers use the same level of care when either doing environmental justice studies or environmental impact studies or setting public hearings, If the same level of care was applied as was applied to this study by Dr. Bell and her colleagues, we would potentially have different outcomes. I think the agencies have a benchmark that is frankly not working for the people who live in communities where these projects are sited, because it rarely ever rises above box checking. So the law requires them to do certain things. Once they've checked off those boxes that they've done those things, then they can proceed with their process toward an outcome that the project builders will tell you at the outset is inevitable for your community. Like, this is going to happen to you, and you can participate or not, but there's not really much that you can do to stop it, is a lot of the message that people receive. And so with this study, I haven't seen very much else like it, frankly, and I certainly haven't seen anything like it come out of a government agency where it was, we want your input on a broad, you know, sampling of topics and subjects, but we really, truly want your input, and we're going to measure it accordingly. And that simply does not happen with permitting. And that's one of the things that I think leads to that sense of despair and this, you know, some of the poor mental health outcomes that we've seen specifically on MVP.
Oh, okay. Well, that leads into my next question, which is, what did the study find? What sorts of impacts did you find?
So I think I mentioned already that this mail survey was the first piece. Then 2 years after this mail survey, we did a more targeted online survey to try to understand some of the mechanisms of the findings that we saw in the first survey. And then we also did 13 semi-structured interviews with landowners on or near the Mountain Valley Pipeline route who had formally submitted comments about the pipeline project during the public commenting periods. And I really believe it's important to triangulate data, and so to make sure that we're gathering quantitative data, but also gathering that really rich qualitative data. And so in both of the surveys, in addition to the interviews, people had the opportunity to write in comments and to expand on some of the answers they were giving to the the multiple choice questions in the survey. So our findings from these three waves of data suggest that the public participation opportunities offered by regulatory agencies during the pipeline certification process are primarily performative. And we found that many of the people who have taken part in these performative public input opportunities have experienced psychological distress, stress-activated physical health effects, and a loss of trust in government institutions. So this research shows that when people engage in public participation processes that have little or no effect on agency decision-making, it not only disempowers them, but it can harm those individuals and erode their trust in government institutions. And we also argue in this article that performative public participation is a violation of procedural and recognition justice, which are two of the core tenets of environmental justice.
From what I read, there were some pretty serious mental health effects.
Yes. We measured psychological distress in the male survey through including the Kessler 6 screening scale for psychological distress, which is a standardized measure of psychological distress. And those were embedded later in the survey. And our statistical analysis found that psychological distress was significantly higher for respondents who engaged in multiple forms of public participation compared to those who did not engage with these opportunities at all. And psychological distress was highest for those who were the most engaged with public participation opportunities. And as I mentioned, we also included a number of places in the survey for people to write in comments and to expand on their answers. And so as far as mental health goes, some of the things that people talked about in those responses to those open-ended questions included being diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, having suicidal thoughts, being prescribed antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications, some for the first time in their lives. And then people also reported developing a whole host of stress-activated health conditions. People talked about developing high blood pressure, heart problems, teeth grinding, headaches, tremors, atrial fibrillation, COPD, shingles, immune system compromises. One person expressed alarm that they knew at least five people along the pipeline route who had died from stress-activated health conditions. Someone else talked about how they had developed heart problems that resulted in hospital visits and said they were afraid to go anywhere alone because they were worried they might have a spell with their heart. Another person noted that they'd had a stroke after arguing with pipeline people, and someone else said they had had a brain hemorrhage the day after attending a FERC monthly meeting, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission meeting. And then one pipeline affected resident who was a well-respected emeritus engineering professor who wrote and submitted over 800 pages of reports to FERC and other agencies detailing the scientific and engineering problems with the Mountain Valley Pipeline Project, told me in our interview that the stress that resulted from having his expertise completely ignored by government agencies was a major contributor to his developing congestive heart failure, which is also a stress-activated health condition. His physician actually advised him against testifying in court for his eminent domain case because she said the stress of doing so could possibly kill him. So reading these comments from our research participants was absolutely heartbreaking, particularly because so many of them devoted so much time to engaging in public commenting periods and scoping meetings, believing that their input could significantly influence the outcome of whether these pipelines were built.
It seems to me that this sort of process that doesn't allow people to actually affect what's going on in their own communities couldn't be good for democracy. Do you agree that that might be the case?
Yes, and unfortunately, most of people's fears and the types of concerns that they were expressing in at every stage, where there was a public hearings at the state and federal level, open comment periods, litigation, where permits were challenged through the court, at every step, people's anxieties and fears were only reinforced by actions of the state or the courts or Congress. All the way up to, you know, we were winning in the courts with successful litigation and attempts to get these agencies to follow the law. And so Congress and the president intervened there with the Fiscal Responsibility Act and then mandated the issuance of all of those permits and stripped jurisdiction away from the court that was hearing those pending cases and then closed the courts to us. So that is kind of the extreme final outcome of this process and how debilitating it is that Dr. Bell has described. We have continued to show up in every single way that we can, just basically not wanting to give up on each other, trying to support each other, you know, maintain that strong solidarity within our communities. And at every turn, they've come up with a new way of basically beating us back down. You know, in addition to those sort of psychological harms, there's also the physical harm to the land and the water that people have been documenting throughout this entire process, and then taking that documentary evidence to the agencies that are supposed to enforce those permits and seeing very little enforcement action as the project is being built, little or none, frankly. All of those examples just, you know, really lead back to how important this study was to kind of bring these things out into the daylight, maybe thinking optimistically so that communities can prepare themselves for what that process is going to be like, and make that determination, you know, we're going to stick together. There's maybe different ways we need to organize around that. But at every turn, we're going to be met with either ambivalence or outright hostility by the people who are supposed to make these decisions with our protection and safety in mind. And that just simply does not happen. And the evidence keeps piling up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and to add to what Russell has beautifully talked about here is the other major finding from the survey was that engaging with regulatory agencies' public participation opportunities led many pipeline-affected residents to lose trust in government institutions. And it's important to underscore here that these folks talked about losing faith in government institutions, which implies that before their experiences with the pipeline permitting process, they had some level of trust in these government agencies. I mean, people who don't believe that government agencies are set up to help them wouldn't be participating in these public commenting processes in the first place. So it was through the process of engaging with these agencies' public input opportunities that their trust was damaged, and all the other ways that Russell just explained. And in our qualitative comments, which were just really striking in this realm, people talked about how they came to feel like the calls for public input were dishonest because, as one person put it, tomes of data are collected, but the approval of the project is never in doubt. And so a lot of our research respondents talked about kind of reaching the same conclusion that FERC and other regulatory agencies are captured by industry. As one person said, I just thought this was a really powerful quote, "We spent the first 3 years of the fight asking FERC to do its job of protecting the public before discovering that protecting the public was never FERC's job. Its job was solely to facilitate the development of pipelines." So, I mean, what you just said, Kay, about this being damaging and problematic for democracy is absolutely true, because if people are losing faith in government institutions to be taking care of people, that's a real problem.
I'm not sure how to go forward with this information. Yeah. Do you have ideas?
So, I mean, that's like the million-dollar question here. You know, I think it might be helpful to kind of just to explain some of the background of like kind of the root of this problem is really rooted in how the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, has been implemented. And so this act was passed in 1969, and procedures were set up to collect information from the public, because that was part of this, was that there need to be opportunities for the public to be heard in decisions that have a significant impact on them and the land. So all these procedures were set up to collect information from the public, but standardized mechanisms to actually incorporate this public feedback into final agency decisions weren't established. So this means that there is wide variability in the degree of influence that this input can have across federal agencies. And the other issue is that NEPA has been treated solely as a procedural statute without institutional expectations or accountability for actually incorporating this public feedback into decisions that are made. So the effect is, whether this is intentional or not, and some scholars say that it is, but the public commenting opportunities can act as a kind of as a release valve of sorts by providing this official venue for people to voice their concerns and opinions. And that could have the effect of channeling energy that might have been better spent in other ways that could have had a greater impact on the outcome, like lobbying legislators or filing lawsuits or engaging in other resistance efforts. But I do, in saying that though, I do want to emphasize that even if these comments aren't making a significant difference in agency decision-making, there are still important reasons to file the comments, specifically in order to make them part of the public record so that they can be used in lawsuits. So I don't necessarily think the answer is telling people not to engage in these public input opportunities, but maybe helping them understand how they will be useful and how they won't be used. But at the same time, I think that we really need to advocate for changes in how this public input is used at the agency level. So there need to be mechanisms in place for this input to actually be able to influence decision-making. I can say more, but Russell, I don't know if you want to add anything.
I agree completely with everything you just described there, and coming back to, you know, sort of trying to prepare people for how to engage, I think is really important and be one of the most valuable ways to use this study across communities, because the pipeline builders are not going to stop. We're going to see this with so-called carbon capture and CO2 pipelines. We're going to see this with LNG build out and petrochemical facilities. And I think as a way of preparing the public right down to the local level for what they're truly up against, reinforcing the idea that if you want to challenge this further down the road, you need to have standing. So come with your local knowledge and wisdom and get that on the record, speak your truth, and know that at somewhere, you know, through the process, you may have another opportunity to use that truth to challenge a bad decision. And like I said, I do think the MVP case is extraordinary because of what Congress did with the Fiscal Responsibility Act. And for folks who are not familiar with that, 11th hour closed door deal that was attached to the debt ceiling bill. And politicians were making all of this noise about, if we don't do this, we're going to drive the global economy off the cliff. So you have to pass this bill in its entirety. And here's this special section, this carve out to finish the Mountain Valley Pipeline. That is an extraordinary and very undemocratic way to force an outcome that one side wanted and erase all of those years of opposition. But along the way, we did bring those successful challenges in the courts by being able to identify people who had standing, who had participated in the process and had testified at public hearings and submitted written comments that, you know, gave the attorneys enough material to continue to work with and also to stay kind of fired up on our behalf, right? Because they care about the region too and the ecosystem and all the things that they were working to protect. But ultimately, it came down to the people and the relationships that they were able to develop with, you know, some of the materials that they put forward in those cases. So that's a really important piece of it. And the erosion of people's confidence in the democratic process, I do want to use some examples of how stark and startling that was for some members of our community, because we're talking in a lot of cases about military veterans. Again, there's a rural, I think fair to describe it as overwhelmingly conservative communities, people who, you know, believed that that system is the best in the world. And therefore, if they participate in the right way, that they'll have positive outcomes. We're then going to public hearings and being met by overwhelming numbers of police presence there to protect the permit writers and decision makers and keep the peace, so to speak, from the rabble-rousers who had showed up, who were very angry about a controversial project, you know, so there's like this physical reaction. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, that's kind of when the reality started to set in that this system is definitely stacked against us and is not representative of what we thought it was in terms of a democratic process.
Talking about democratic process, I have heard from people who've had some effect. And they said the thing that worked most was having one-on-one or small groups of people meeting with the legislator, not just once, but over and over, because I've had legislators tell me, you know, they first got elected and they were so excited and they walked into the Capitol at Harrisburg and there was lobbyist after lobbyist after lobbyist after lobbyist after lobbyist trying to buttonhole them. So just a little FaceTime with your legislator, they said really helped. So I don't know if that's something that people have tried or found any effect at all.
Yeah, Russell, you all have had a lot of interface with legislators, some of which have been helpful, some of which have not.
Yes, I think we have a number of allies in this movement that understand that we have to build a system that actually serves us. And I do think it takes what you've described, you know, repeat visits, repeat engagement, making sure that they know who you are and what your concerns are, your causes, what you're specifically asking them to do. But on their end, they really do need to follow up with more concrete actions before I think people will have true faith in that system. And the reason I say that is because we're borrowing church vans or carpooling long distances to get to our state capitals, to get to our federal capital, to meet with these people. And our adversaries have millions upon millions to basically plant somebody down there, down the hall practically from them, to be able to go in and have regular meetings. Never mind the campaign contributions and all of the other awful things that we know uphold that system. It is incredibly hard for those of us who live down in these remote rural areas to physically get to those meetings. We're talking about working people, people who have childcare needs, who can't just drop everything that they're doing to go try to get a sympathetic ear or bring pressure on decision makers who I frankly think know what the problem is, right? It's just that the meetings that they're taking are more often than not with these moneyed interests and these corporate interests who call the shots over and over and over again. I'll use sort of an alarming example that's kind of looming ahead for however the MVP fight resolves when it's all over, and that's so-called permitting reform. There's an overwhelming support for moving us off of fossil fuels, moving us to a renewable energy future, and the fossil fuel industry is, I think, really capitalizing on the desire to get green or so-called clean energy projects approved to speed up the permitting process to actually allow them to build more of what they want to build under the guise of moving us towards that transition. And so who are the decision makers going to be talking to? They're going to be talking to utilities. They're going to be talking to energy companies. They're going to be talking to people from Wall Street. And it'll be harder and harder for us to get any of those meetings, much less get to them. So we have to be very careful about making sure that we don't miss an opportunity here to prevent them from making the problem worse under the guise of trying to do something better through permitting reform.
And part of that can, and I think should, mean creating more decentralized and democratically owned energy systems that aren't owned by big utility companies. I feel like if more communities had the ability to say no to pipelines or other big energy development projects, we might consider other ways of designing energy systems that are more aligned with environmental justice goals and with the well-being of the more than human world.
This isn't energy, but it's another utility, which is water. In Pennsylvania, we're having a fight going on with companies buying out communities' water systems, you know, saying, okay, we're going to fix them up. The rates are going to be low and everything. And then people find out, oops, their rates went up. So that's been happening in community after community, and there is now significant pushback. Do you think we need a new philosophy? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you're talking about is capitalism always wins. Instead of measuring the well-being of our society, of nations by GDP or gross domestic product, we should be measuring it by the health of citizens and other well-being quality of life measures. And I mean, I think there's a really interesting way that we could think about other ways of prioritizing well-being in different ways, because there's a lot of research that has shown that high levels of energy use, and I know you're talking about water, but just to bring it back to energy, that high levels of energy use are not closely connected with societal well-being as measured through the mental and physical health of the general public. And one really interesting alternative way to measure the well-being of a society beyond these traditional economic measures like GDP is something called the Happy Planet Index, which was developed by the New Economics Foundation. And it calculates happy life years for nations using self-reported life satisfaction levels and life expectancy, and then dividing that value by the per capita ecological footprint of that nation. So research using this Happy Planet Index has shown that most of the nations with the highest score on this index are in Latin America, with Costa Rica scoring the highest. And the United States ranks 114th out of 143 nations. So the index shows that there are many so-called less developed countries where people actually report having very high levels of satisfaction and live long lives, but have relatively small ecological footprints. So, and if we could shift how we're measuring success in government agencies facilitating different infrastructure or needs in its citizenry, then I think we could have a different kind of world where we're not having a situation where companies are making a profit off of the backs of local people who are just trying to live a life.
Sorry. Underpinning all of this is absolutely the problem of the profit motive, profit incentive, and the economic arguments that are always made for approving projects. Very few of those economic benefits actually stay within the local community. The profits are siphoned off and local communities are left with the cleanup. And we see this over and over and over again, no matter what the project is. I'm blessed and fortunate to live in one of the most beautiful areas of the country that I've ever had privilege and pleasure of living in. But if I cannot drink my household water, I cannot stay here. And that is true for so many people across the region. It's happening in Southern West Virginia right now, where the grassroots and the communities are trying to organize to get people water that they can safely drink in their homes and bathe with, and, you know, feed their livestock with, because their local water sources are contaminated by spillover from the collapsing coal interests in the region, right? So all of the harm and the cleanup is socialized. The profit has been exported out of the state. And this is outrageous. This is a moral failure by this nation to have allowed these industries to come in, extract people's labor, extract their health, and leave them with this lingering despair, because as beautiful as the region is, it is unhealthy for them to live there and raise their families there. And that isn't something that is going to be corrected through permitting reform or even lobbying. I think it's a moral failure to allow people to live in those conditions after they've given their bodies and their health and their futures to those industries for the sake of jobs and promised economic benefit. And so from the grassroots perspective, I think you'll see a shift in the way, after the MVP fight, that we try to organize and really connect from community to community here in the region. And I don't care how you voted, frankly. That's another complaint that I see all the time, that somehow people deserve these outcomes because of how an election turned out in their region. I frankly do not care how you voted, what flag you hang from your porch. If your water is poisoned and you want to fix that, then I think we need to organize in that fashion and, you know, make the ecosystem and the community healthy again so that people can be healthy again.
Shannon?
You know, a lot of people criticize degrowth as being unrealistic, but what is actually unrealistic is the idea that we're going to be able to address the climate crisis without scaling back our obsession with growth. I really think it's unrealistic to think that we can geoengineer our way out of the climate crisis without a whole slew of unintended consequences, ranging from out of control waste streams to geopolitical conflict. I mean, why not try to create a better society in the process of trying to address the climate crisis? One that prioritizes health, well-being, environmental connection and environmental protection, community, art, rest. That sounds like a much better world to me.
Okay. And if people want to find out more, what do you suggest?
So the article is, we published it open access, and so people can read the entire study if they just Google Pipelines and Power, and so they should be able to find the open access article.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
If you want to know more about Planet Philadelphia, go to planetphiladelphia.com. You could also find out more about other G-Town Radio programming by going to gtownradio.com. I hope you will consider making a small monthly donation to help Planet Philadelphia continue presenting interviews on important underreported environmental topics and exploring their complexities and intersections. Thank you so much for your support.